Welcome to Two Slant Trees, the podcast where a married couple learn to cope differently during social isolation while reading Brené Brown's The Gift of Imperfection together. This is episode 7, and today we're going to be talking about cultivating a resilient spirit. Well, for you, what comes to mind when you think of a resilient person? Or you can maybe throw that question back at me, but...
I would say somebody who doesn't give up easily and can see a way through a difficult circumstance.
Yeah. Seems like a good definition.
That's just the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah, for me, it's people that come to mind. Or it's the people that I turn to when I'm not sure what to do next. So, generally, they're people that are optimistic, although sometimes I would say they're a bit reckless. But they kind of help me get out of a bind. But they also have like it's people that have the ability to kind of step outside of themselves a little bit, right? So they don't maybe experience their emotions all in one moment. They can kind of step away from it and kind of process it from that perspective.
Yeah.
Anyway, so according to Brené Brown's research. So this is guidepost number 3, cultivating resilience. She has kind of 5 markers of someone who's resilient. So the first one is resilient people have good problem-solving skills. Secondly, they are more likely to seek help. They have the belief that they can do something that will help them manage their feelings and cope. Fourth, they have a social support system available to them. And fifth, they are connected to others, such as family and friends.
That sounds pretty good. Although, you know, we just like jumped right in.
We did. We didn't have any jokes today.
Sorry, we had no jokes.
Nothing funny happened today.
Well, that's not true. Because at one point during the day, Jack and Teddy were jumping on the couch. And Jack kept saying, or Teddy kept being like, I'm going to give you another shiner. And then Jack's running away, and then Teddy is chasing him around the house, being like, I'm going to give you another shiner. Jack, it's time for your other shiner.
Really? I think I maybe heard that while I was, I had a Bible study tonight, so I locked myself in the office to have a call with some students. I heard some screaming.
Oh, it wasn't quite like that. That was other stuff. That was them just...
That was
anyways,
just
that was okay. The funny quote from the day.
So,
okay.
Teddy was... Okay. So, that's funny. You guys can laugh.
Yeah.
In the comfort of your own home.
So, one of the things, going back to resilience, she says resilience requires, quote, spirit or spirituality. She says it's key, like spirit or spirituality is key because it brings a sense of perspective, meaning, and purpose to our lives.
Yeah.
And gives us this sense that there's something greater and shows us that we're interconnected.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about spirituality now, or do you want to save that for later?
We can save that for later.
Okay.
Yeah, so then moving on from that, the foundation of spirituality as being a key, she says there's 3 other significant things that came out of her research was that people that were being essential to resilience. So people who cultivated hope, they practiced critical awareness, and they let go of numbing and taking edge off vulnerability, discomfort, and pain. So they were able to be hopeful and be critically aware and didn't numb. So
yeah,
I thought that was interesting. She also kind of goes on to talking about how hope is not an emotion. It's a way of thinking or a cognitive process.
Yeah, it's a thought process or a mindset. But it's not fully... Yeah, it's not just like an emotional like optimism.
No.
It's like, I'm just a cheery person. But it's a bit more like a concrete way of approaching the world. It's like a... Yeah, it's a practice or an activity.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to remember that it's not optimism. Because there are some people who are just like constantly optimistic. They always see like...
The bright side.
The bright side. And
Mr.
That's,
bright side.
And that's not... bad, but sometimes that is it's coloring reality, like
yeah, because you can't, it's hard to trust those people too
sometimes at a certain
point.
For us,
like they're not, you can't be vulnerable. Well, yeah, for us, but I think it's hard to be vulnerable to someone who's always going to try to look on the bright side of whatever,
or right? They like, think everything is going to work out when you're like, actually it's not going to work out this time.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Doo-doo. So that's not Mr. Brightside.
No, that's Life of Brian.
Yeah, okay. So it's not optimism, but it's also not optimism. I can't remember what I was going to say. So she also says that hopelessness, if you lack hope, it can lead to powerlessness. So there's this like way that hope and power work together.
Yeah. So if you have hope, it's empowering. It kind of gives you the strength to actually do something about your situation. But if you're hopeless, then you're also powerless to face whatever's in front of you.
Yeah, which seems kind of obvious, I guess. But I don't know. Like, if you're hopeless, you're powerless. I don't know. But I guess I wouldn't put those things two together naturally. I wouldn't think, like, hope and power work together. But so when she says, if we want to cultivate hopefulness, we have to be willing to be flexible and demonstrate perseverance. Not every goal will look and feel the same. And we have to have tolerance for disappointment, determination, and a belief in self are at the heart of hope. It's funny because I kind of think of that as the definition of resilience, tolerance for disappointment, and having determination. But and a belief in self. Okay. But I don't know. I think I'm pretty resilient. You always say I'm pretty resilient, and I'm not sure. I always think of it as belief in myself.
More of like I just keep on trucking.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's a keep on trucking attitude, or it's like I've asked myself, why is it that I can like push through, persevere through things? Not push through in this negative sense, but like I think it's because I see options where other people don't see options.
So you see that you can actually do something.
Yeah, I see a way out. You're able to avoid
that feeling of powerlessness where it's like, oh, there's nothing. I should just sit here and wait for it to happen to me.
Yeah. And I think other people see that as have said, you're like, you're so strong. Like they've said it's a strength, but I think it's actually more of like, I just see it a way when other people don't see a way.
Yeah. I think too, recognizing that hope is something that's, it's not guaranteed either, right? Like there is a sense of it's in the future, right? And so if you're waiting to be 100% certain, it's hard to have hope, I guess. If you're waiting to be fully confident of what's going to happen, that's not really operating from hope. That's operating from control.
Yes.
And then you can feel like, oh, I've lost control. I'm powerless. But hope kind of can operate even when you don't have control over the situation. But you can kind of trust in something good happening.
Yeah, because hope is like, or you don't always see the way, but you know that one will come.
Yeah.
If you keep moving forward, it's that I think the idea of like, I guess in a sense of resilience, like you continue moving even when you're not sure what the next step is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think too, like just using these words, because like Brené Brown talks about spirituality and hope is obviously a spiritual word. And I think kind of the way she's using it, I think that again, it's like I said earlier in one different episode about some of the things she says, I think they rhyme with Christianity.
Yeah.
Right. It's not exactly what the Bible teaches, but it's kind of similar to it. Because like hope, I would say, is something that's kind of baked into the way that God made the world. And it's something that everyone should be able to perceive at some level, right? Because if God made the world and everything in it to be good, then we should be able to find good things when we look at them, when we look at the world, you know? And I think, so we said earlier, this is the way I would see it, because we mentioned earlier that I grew up on a farm, right? And it's actually the same farm my dad grew up on. Anyways, I was struck a few years ago, I'm not sure when, but like how, so my dad grew up on this farm, and so that everything that his big family and then my family had growing up was really dependent on the dirt, really the mud on this farm being able to produce life, right? To produce a crop that you could then feed to cows and then turn into milk and then turn it into money, and then you could provide for a family through that, right?
Yeah.
And so but it's kind of there's something really striking about that, where it's like you can kind of trust this process of farming to kind of bring growth and to bring life and to provide for all of our needs, you know? And Yeah, and you kind of have to have hope to make that work, because if the land didn't produce even 1 year, you'd be pretty miserable. But kind of that formula of mud plus sun equals life and growth, that's just the way it kind of baked into the world. Now, if you know anything about farming, there's mud plus sun plus blood, sweat, and tears equals...
And rain.
And rain. yeah, water. Is
and not, rain at the right time and not too much.
Not too much, yeah. So, I mean, but you kind of have to... It operates from a place of hope, I think. I guess maybe if as a poet I could do this better, but I think the idea that things will just grow and give life is really cool. And just like that's the way the whole world works, that it's alive and it's growing. And even to the level of like a farm, you can see like that's just how God actually made the world, to live and to grow and to provide for our needs.
So are you saying that there is a natural predictability to the world?
I think, well, to a certain degree, like I think it's just kind of, I think it's, like, it's just rational to be hopeful at a certain level, right? Because that's just the way God made the world, that we can expect good things. Now, I think as Christians, we know it's because God is good and because of the promises that he's made. Mm-hmm. But it is just like an objective kind of reality.
Which is kind of funny because you and I tend to be kind of cynical though, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But like, I think that's where like cynical versus optimistic are kind of not the right categories, because hope,
yeah.
I think the deeper truth too, I think hope as Christians
those things.
Is that like hope is not just like an emotion
as
opposed to being cynical. But like for Christians, hope is a person, right?
Yeah.
And it's that you trust in Jesus to save you. And then it really doesn't matter what your personality is, right? Because he saves, right? Because the Bible says Jesus came to save sinners, right? And I'm the first. Or Jesus came to save jerks, and I'm the first.
Yeah.
And so it's not a mindset. It's not a way of looking at the world. It's this person that you can trust.
Yeah, right? And that's, I think, where I kind of disagreed with some of the things that she said, because, it's... Who am I to disagree? But, like, she says... hope happens when we have the ability to set realistic goals. We're able to figure out how to achieve those goals, including the ability to stay flexible and develop alternative routes, and when we believe in ourselves. And so she kind of summarizes those by saying, I know where I want to go. I know how to get there. I'm persistent and I can tolerate disappointment and try again, and I can do this. But I think in my own faith in the last, I don't know, probably since we've had kids, that I've been able to come to the end of myself in a good way, and to be to admit to myself, I can't do this. And that's actually where the hope has come in, because I am turning to Jesus, Jesus, the person of hope.
Yeah.
Instead of like hoping in my own self.
Yeah.
So I think.
Yeah. And have realism in what we're hoping for. Right. Like, to use that farm analogy, if we tried to grow, like, bananas, that would be really dumb. That would be bananas.
That would. But I'm...
Yeah. But, because the climate's not right for it, right? And so, even in our own lives, if we're trying, what are we trying to grow? Is it something that makes even any sense?
Trying to grow bananas is just delusional, right?
So if you're not in, like, a tropical climate, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, so what's the difference between hope and delusion?
Well, I think delusion's... Man? No, hope is based in reality. It's like an objective reality. Like, you expect life to happen, but there's things that you can know that won't happen. It's not that you're not a pessimist if you're like, I don't think bananas are a good crop for Montreal.
So this is, so I, growing up, I...
You like, wanted to be a banana farmer?
Bananarama, the banana shack. No, I got this nickname from my high school girlfriends. Basically, from a world religions class, they started calling me Shiva, which is the god of destruction in Hinduism, because I was always the one ruining everything with my realism / pessimism / I thought it was realism. But like, they would say something like, I want to like become a change banana farmer in like in Eastern Ontario, and I'd be like, that's the dumbest thing ever. Well, I wouldn't, maybe I would say that, but I would say like, that's not possible, and they'd be like, shh, way to ruin it for me. And I'm like, well, it's just reality.
Did anyone say like, I want to be a doctor, and you're like, you're not smart enough?
No, I did not,
because that would actually be mean.
That would be mean. No, I would say things that they didn't like. And so I got, and I still do it. Yeah. They'd be like, why would you say that? And I'm like, I don't know, it's true. They're like, could you just not say it? I was like, I guess, but... Yeah.
Anyways. Okay, so that's hope. I wanted to talk about numbing.
Yes. Right? So she does go into talking about... she moves into talking about the next... she calls it practicing critical awareness, which is like having reality checks. Like in the reality checks, I guess that is kind of related to what you're saying, because she asks, like, is what I'm seeing real? Do these images convey real life or fantasy? So helpful for us when we are on social media seeing all kinds of things that you're just like, is that even people's real life? Like, is this just, you know, the quote unquote highlight reel? Or also the asking the question, do these images reflect healthy, wholehearted living, or do they turn my life, body, family, relationships into objects and commodities? And then the other question is, who benefits by my seeing these images and feeling bad about myself?
Yeah.
So those are some, she gives that as an example of questions to ask ourselves when we're seeing bombarded by like marketing images or, you know, highlight reel stuff on social media. Those are highlight or reality checks. And then she moves into talking about numbing and taking the edge off. So one of the things she talks about, when she interviewed people, they were always talking about trying to feel feelings, staying mindful about numbing behaviors, and trying to lean into the discomfort of hard emotions, which is tough stuff. Then she goes into this whole like thing about being a recovering alcoholic. So yeah. I think if she at the time she said she was 15 years sober. So if, since publishing, if she stayed sober, that will be like 25 years almost of sobriety. And she says, before conducting this research, I thought numbing and taking the edge off was just about addiction, but I don't believe that anymore. And I think that's pretty key. Because what she's saying is it's not just addicts that do that. It's we all do it.
Yeah.
So do you want to, should we talk about some of this a little bit more, or you want to go into what you were talking about numbing?
No, really just that like a lot of us practice different, she didn't fit into like maybe a full-blown alcoholic, but like had these practices of, or just ways of living where it's like, I just need to take the edge off, right?
Yeah,
like,
and I guess...
I need a drink, or I just need a bag of Doritos.
Right, and she realized that partly because she never really fit into the Alcoholics Anonymous culture. Because the way called herself the taking the edge off kind of alcoholic, along with...
There's an unhealthy pattern. Versus... It wasn't necessarily an addiction. It was just like a way of coping that was
But she was addicted to the pattern.
Yeah.
Right? Like it was an unhealthy coping mechanism that turned into an addiction.
Yeah.
And I think... So, I mean, it's like, I don't know if it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, but knowing some people in the recovery community who do attend Alcoholics Anonymous and like... the program can be very strict about the way that they view
what
things.
They're taking you through
and it's and it's beneficial, but like sometimes people don't always fit the mold perfectly, and she was one of those people. But she said for her, she didn't lose everything to her drinking, but she did find it got in the way of practicing vulnerability, and that's why she quit drinking, which is like an incredibly insightful and intense thing to do. But like I was thinking, this is like what she was describing is like super normal. Like how many of us have seen people on TV be like, oh, I need a drink, like after a hard day, and or like I don't know, I think we all have stuff like this, like you said, just kill a bag of Doritos.
And I think too, like I like that kind of speaks to me the first time I read it, and then when I reread it again this week, because now that we're on social isolation, all of my take the edge off behaviors aren't really available to me right now. Right. So like in the past, if I was working from home and I was getting like antsy or whatever, I could go to work at a coffee shop for an hour, you know, and just like be around people and have a coffee and, you know, but like, I can't leave my house now. So I just have to like deal with it if the kids are too loud. or like the office is closed.
Yeah.
So I can't go and like joke around with coworkers on lunch break.
Yep.
Right, and kind of like take the edge off that way.
You can joke around with me or I coworker. Can, but
yeah, or the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not as funny.
They don't get my jokes. I don't know if anyone does. Or even at the office, I'll eat candy.
Yes, you do.
Right, I'll kind of stress eat candy sometimes to excess. But I can't do that at home because the kids will see me and they'll want some too.
No, I've found some little pockets of candy around the house.
Yeah, I gotta be very careful.
You have to strategically like hide in the bathroom and eat candy or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But who wants like poop candy? Poop particle candy.
Maybe that does make me an addict.
You're like, I'd do it. I mean, we could buy
a bag candy of dispenser in the bathroom.
A bag of Doritos a day.
We could, but you but can only go once a week.
We would get really fat.
Yeah. Anyways.
But it does reflect.
So it just kind of reveals what's going on. And I'm probably picking up other kind of bad habits. But I think one of the things she said that was interesting is like when you numb the pain, then the joy is going to be blurry too, right? You just kind of get numb to a lot of things. And so even if I'm like, oh, I'm tired and these kids are annoying and I'm like, I just got to go get a coffee instead of being able to be with them. Well, I'm missing out on good moments with them too, right?
I mean, you got to work, but.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think. Yeah, what she means by that is, like, if we are numbing the intensity of our discomfort, our uncomfortable feelings, then there's a good chance that we're going to be uncomfortable with the highs as well. Like, yeah. the pure joy or whatever else, that will be foreign and uncomfortable too. Probably not consciously, but we end up numbing both. And she kind of like she explains it like this. She says we can't make a list of all the quote bad emotions and say I'm going to numb these, and then make a list of the positive emotions and say I'm going to fully engage in these. You can imagine the vicious cycle this creates. I don't experience much joy, so I have no reservoir to draw from when things are hard. Things happen, they feel even more painful, so I numb, so I don't experience joy, and so on.
Yeah. It's kind of like you have to like work your emotional muscles a bit.
Yeah.
To have a bit more range. Or be flexibility. I don't know. Emotional yoga.
Yoga.
We are not a yoga household. Well, you can, but I'm not going to do it.
So, then she, let's see. So she says, yeah, we basically need to learn that recognizing and leaning into the discomfort of vulnerability teaches us how to live with joy, gratitude, and grace. Which are also very like spiritual kind of phrases.
Yeah.
This kind of also reminds me of that idea that like Henry Cloud talks about this, that like people are not all good or all bad.
Yeah.
Like that we make good choices, we make poor choices. And so I think sometimes we can look at ourselves and the decisions that we feel ashamed of, that we went numb from or whatever, it's because we think I am bad.
Hmm.
I guess that's the shame thing, right? When we're talking about that. Yeah. Anyways. So then she asks the question, is spirituality a necessary component for resilience? She says the answer is yes.
Yeah. But then here, let me have a look at this, because she's like, spirituality is necessary. But then she says, I didn't find that any one interpretation of spirituality has the corner on the resilience market.
Just anybody who had just in like, her opinion.
It's like we all have to define spirituality in a way that inspires us. And of course,
we think that's dumb.
I guess
we're going to say a nicer way to
do
say
we.
It.
I was going to say I think that's dumb, but we feels more authoritative. It's like the Queen, the royal we. The Queen of England.
We are one.
The Queen of England probably thinks that's dumb. Yeah.
I agree with you. I think it's dumb.
Because that meme with Jack Donahue from 30 Rock, where someone's like, "My daughter's an angel." And he's like, well, so was Lucifer. Is that the quiet? So was Lucifer. Right? So it's like, you don't know what angel or what spirit you're getting into, right? Like, it might be, like, why would you want to get into spirituality? There's, like, really bad spirituality out there.
Yeah.
Right? So I think, but I do think there is, like, I don't think she's a demon worshiper.
No.
I don't think that's what the vibe I'm getting here. But, like, I think there's a sense of, like, yes, that, like, there's a spiritual realm that goes beyond what we can kind of work out in the material world, right? And if you're only going to limit yourself to what you can totally figure out, like on a materialistic level, I think you're going to go crazy.
Yeah, you're losing me here, sweetie.
Well, if you like, I think maybe what she's getting at is like there's a world, the levels of the world that we just can't understand, and that's maybe what she's getting at in terms of what spirituality is. It's something that is connects all of humanity and is kind of beyond just a purely objective, rational approach to the world.
Well, I thought she, because didn't she kind of define spirituality before a little bit earlier, which basically said, she said spirituality is recognizing and celebrating that we are all linked to each other by a greater power than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion. Practicing spirituality brings a sense of perspective, meaning, and purpose in our lives. So yeah, I guess it does, it's this idea of like a god or an energy could be that unites us or whatever.
Star Wars.
Star Wars, the Force.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that grounded in love and compassion. So, I mean, it does represent what we would say the Judeo-Christian God represents those things. Like, in the sense that the person, the power is grounded in love and compassion. Yeah,
that there's something beyond us that is benevolent and maybe loves us and is looking out for us. And I think that certainly helps. And it is, I think it's, as Christians we can say, that's true.
Yeah.
And it would help if people realize that there was a God that loves them.
Yeah, because karma is not helpful. But
there's like a reality to that. But it made me think of this other quote from this book that Jess got me for Christmas or my birthday a couple years ago.
Yeah, Christmas.
Because of what it means even to be a Christian and how that works with, well, all these other terms. Anyways,
he's looking
at. I'm going to read it, and then I'll hopefully it'll make sense. Anyways, this is actually a quote of a quote in Fleming Rutledge's book on the crucifixion. It says, and it says, Christian faith is based on religious claims concerning the present power of Jesus. Christian faith is not directed toward a human construction about the past. That would be a form of idolatry. Authentic Christian faith is a response to the living God, whom Christians declare is powerfully at work among them through the resurrected Jesus. And I think there's a real contrast there between faith in the resurrected Jesus, which is really concrete and is a relationship, and sort of vague spirituality, right? That spirituality really doesn't hold a candle to the idea of, or to the reality that, that we actually, Jesus is at work in our lives right now. Anyways. Share that quote to kind of show that contrast between faith and spirituality. It's maybe a bit unique to this author, but I just recommend that book, The Crucifixion by Fleming Rutledge, and you can kind of understand, what it means, like, not just like spirituality, but actually a God that loves us enough to die for us is actually what's going on in the universe. And that is why we can kind of enter into any situation.
Yeah, because
that... And not numb ourselves from it.
Right. That's where the, like, hope becomes real, because... It's like, I tend to end up feeling like nothing, like I'm indestructible, you know, like that idea that, you know, like Jesus came and conquered sin and death for me. And like, it, you know, it's, I guess that quote, like, God is for us, who can be against us? Like,
yeah,
you know, sure. But I mean, not in a prosperity sense, but in the sense that like, you know, I can weather anything. Like, no matter what, like, if something terrible happens to this family, heaven forbid, like, Jesus will help me, like, figure it out. Like, he will help me through it. And that's, like, that's a real hope. That's...
Yeah, because it feels like it. Then it's grounded in something beyond ourselves or just a mindset.
Yeah, because, I mean, I, like, if anything happened to our entire family, like... Sure, I would probably sink into a very terrible depression, but that would still be okay. Like, God would still... There's still hope in Jesus. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, we have a new...
But, like, yeah, that you can still... A hopeful mindset is a good thing no matter what. But it seems like it has more concrete reality
when you base
it in who Jesus is.
I think one that's rooted in God has more staying power, I guess.
Yeah.
So she says, without purpose, meaning, and perspective, it's easy to lose hope, numb our emotions, or become overwhelmed by our circumstances. We feel reduced, less capable, and lost in the face of struggle. So the heart of spirituality is connection, and when we believe in that inextricable connection, we don't feel alone. So I think she talks about, yeah, like bringing back or bringing that in, that idea of courage, compassion, and connection. Like, so what do we do? Like, what, I guess, what do we do if we are, instead of numbing? Timmy, are you going to tell us? What do you think? That is a big question that I think we should all reflect on, especially given the situation that we're all in at this point. Like, now more than ever, we need to recognize those coping mechanisms that we have. Yeah, yeah.
Because I think I mentioned, like, I've lost some of my take off the edge aholism that I had maybe at a regular work day.
Yeah.
But there's other ones that are more available to me now too, right? Like, that it's just like, I'm just in the house all day and I don't go out and have meaningful interactions that kind of pull me out of myself in the way I would. Or I don't see people that, like, maybe challenge me in different ways. So I really control my interactions with other people now.
Yeah.
And I can spend a lot more time online. And so then the risk of numbing is actually higher in those things.
Yeah. So, yeah, we need to take stock of, like, how we are coping and try and do so in a healthier way.
Yeah.
And so tomorrow we'll be talking about cultivating gratitude and joy. And we will put the links in the show notes for the book that Willie made reference to. And I wanted to share a song that I forgot to put in the podcast the other day, by Andrew Peterson. It's called Be Kind to Yourself, and it's just a very tender, nice song. So I will link to that as well. So that's all for now.
That's all for Two Slant Trees for today. We leaned on each other, got through it.
Indeed.
Okay, do you want to say bye, Timmy? Timmy's with us right now.
Nope.
No.
Okay.
No. No words from Tim.
Adios.